And stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPBC-LPFM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
Let's go.
Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we're going to be talking with Heidi Altman, legal director of the Capital Area Immigrants' Rights Coalition, also called the CARE Coalition, about legal issues facing non-citizens in the justice system. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, as legal director for the CARE Coalition, what's your background? How did you end up in that role?
That's a great question. So, immigration issues compel me, and I struggle to know exactly why, but I think personally for me, there's something very moving about the strength that it takes to make a choice to uproot yourself and move yourself and maybe your family to a new home and a new country. And so I come from a background first of international human rights. I studied international human rights and came to see the issues around immigration and immigrants in the United States as one of the most pressing civil rights and civil liberties issues of our times.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to New York University Law School. I went to Yale undergraduate.
Wow, okay. We've got some high firepower in here today. So what specifically is the mission of the CARE Coalition? Can you talk to me a little bit about just sort of what that group does?
Absolutely. So we are based in D.C., and we do what we can, the best that we can, to protect the rights, provide legal representation to immigrants who are facing deportation proceedings from detention. And there are right now 5 different detention facilities that we serve for adults, and we also serve children who are facing removal proceedings in Virginia and Maryland who have come here unaccompanied, arrived across the border.
So your geographic area, if I'm right, is Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. itself.
That's right.
And you were talking about people who are in detention. What does that mean? There's lots of, some people out there may not know what that means.
I think a lot of people out there don't know what that means. And in fact, I really believe that if more people knew what it means, that there would be more outrage than we see. But what it means is that Immigration and Customs Enforcement for adults and some children has a really sprawling network of jails across the United States. And it is by law a civil detention system, but they look and act and feel like jails. Well, that's exactly what our clients ask us all the time. So because deportation is not a criminal penalty, it's a civil penalty. So this is not a criminal punishment, and the detention facilities are civil, but the way the system has sprung up, driven in large part by the for-profit prison industry, many of the facilities where immigrants are held are just regular local jails that have contracts with Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
When you say the for-profit prison industry, talk to me a little bit about what that means and how that intersects here.
Yeah. So when Immigration and Customs Enforcement apprehends someone, and I'll just say ICE because that's a little bit easier, when ICE takes someone into custody, they have the discretion to hold that person in one of many of their detention facilities. And there are a small number of detention facilities that are immigration-only facilities, but for most people, they're going to end up held in a local jail. I'll give as an example, there's a jail on the eastern shore of Maryland, the Worcester County Jail, and they have a contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. If you are the immigrant being held in detention, it doesn't look or feel any different to you than being in jail for a criminal offense.
Okay.
But it is technically civil detention.
And who makes money off of this?
The for-profit prison industry makes money.
In other words, if it's a jail that's holding the person, do they get paid to hold the person?
They have a contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
And does that contract mean that Immigration and Customs Enforcement pays the jail?
It does.
Okay.
It does.
So there's some incentive there.
Yes. All the places that you logically think that goes are correct.
Are where it goes.
Are absolutely where it goes. And so, you know, the same way that mass incarceration in the criminal justice system in the United States is very much driven by economic incentives. So is the mass incarceration of immigrants in the detention and deportation system.
So some of these people in these detention centers, which are really just in jail, are they, is everybody there someone who's committed a crime and that's how they came to the attention of the authorities? Or are they just someone who might have been acquitted of a crime, or does crime have nothing to do with it? How's it break out?
It breaks out into a number of different categories. So no, to answer your first question, they're not all people coming from the criminal justice system.
Okay.
ICE at this point in time really has sort of two categories of people who they have publicly announced that they are focusing on as priorities for who they're going to use their money to try to detain and deport from the United States. And the first category is who, you know, the administration refers to as recent border crossers.
Okay.
So that's people who recently arrived. You know, from the perspective of someone who, you know, myself and my colleagues are actually meeting people in the facilities, one big problem with that is that that category includes asylum seekers and people who cross the border because they are fleeing violence in their home countries.
When you say asylum seeker, tell me what that means. Give me an example of what kind of person would be an asylum seeker.
Well, you know, I think the classic, when someone thinks about an asylum seeker, the classic image is someone who is fleeing from a politically repressive country. And we do see a good number of that sort of classic presentation in the detention facilities. And so that might be, you know, someone who is fleeing a repressive government in Africa and other parts of the countries and gets to the United States somehow, and at the airport actually expresses to an officer that they are afraid to return to their country, and that person at that point will be taken into detention. That's the more classic presentation, but I think, you know, the nature of what it means to be a refugee has changed very much in recent years, and we do, of course, face a refugee crisis right now in Central America. And so a lot of the children that CARE Coalition serves and their moms and sometimes their dads are coming across the southern border from unimaginable, really horrific levels of violence in Central America caused by gang and organized crime and cartels. And those are, from our staff's conversation with them, very much refugees. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has found that to be true as well. And so they are in our facilities as well, facing detention, facing removal proceedings.
So are we talking about there being kids in jail? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, so there's a different system of detention for kids who come across the border unaccompanied.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, literally it is so dangerous in these countries that parents are making this excruciating decision, not uncommonly now, to, you know, do I let my child stay here knowing that he will either be killed or be recruited as a gang member, or do I send him on this dangerous journey to the United States? And it is a very dangerous journey. If a child arrives unaccompanied in that way, from Guatemala, from Honduras, from El Salvador, then he or she, and increasingly it's girls who are fleeing this violence, will go into a shelter that's run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement and hopefully be reunified from with a family member, but will be put in deportation proceedings and does not have a right to appointed counsel. So we do the best we can to provide lawyers in that
case. So mom or dad or both ship this child across the border, and the child arrives in the States and is taken into custody somewhere. They try to place the child with a relative who might be in the States.
Yeah.
But then they deport the child. And in the deportation proceedings, they don't get a lawyer.
That's right.
Why don't they get a lawyer?
That's a great question. And there's pending lawsuit asking that same question right now. By the ACLU and others arguing that unaccompanied children should have the right to a lawyer. I don't have a good answer to your question because I don't think there is a good answer. And if you go into court, I just think it is contrary to everything we hold to be American values. You have 11, 12, 13-year-old kids without lawyers standing up trying to articulate their defense to their deportation.
You mean there are literally 11-year-old children standing up in a courtroom with nobody sitting beside them talking to the judge about why they shouldn't be shipped out of here back whatever hellhole they came from.
That's right. And the government has a lawyer representing their interests. So there is a lawyer in the courtroom, but that lawyer is
trying to get them out of here
for removal.
Wow. Okay. Well, I am a criminal defense attorney. That's what I do.
Yes.
So I want to sort of get into the subject with you of the intersection of immigration law and criminal law.
Right.
Because I see this sometimes in my practice.
Right.
So what I want to talk about is the disparate impact of criminal convictions on immigrants.
Yeah.
And in particular, I want to talk about, you know, first off, just as ground rules, that I'm not talking just about illegal immigrants.
Right.
I'm talking about people who are legally here in the United States. Somebody who's got a green card, somebody who came completely legally, and they're okay to be here, and they're okay to work here. Maybe they've lived here forever. What happens to some of those people? What happens different for an immigrant who's convicted of something minor?
Right.
Let's say a DUI, although I hate to minimize that, or a shoplifting, or, but you know, we're not talking about axe murder. I'm talking about, you know, something, a misdemeanor of some sort.
That's
what kind of things can happen to them?
A lot of really bad things can happen. And so I appreciate you asking the question the way that you did, because first of all, I think the intersection of criminal and immigration law, more and more it feels like the same area of law. They're always intertwined. So we represent a lot of green card holders or lawful permanent residents, it's the same thing, who go through the criminal justice system. And because of an offense that a citizen would deal with through community service, maybe a short time in jail, maybe some probation, and then move on with their lives, our clients then end up in detention for sometimes months, sometimes longer than a year, and sometimes end up with a deportation order. And the nature of a deportation order is such that it is essentially permanent exile. Usually you cannot ever return to the United States. And the thing about long-time green card holders is that they have American lives, and they often have U.S. citizen spouses and children. And so it's not just a disparate impact on them, but it's then the ripple impacts on their families, on their communities. And so what we frequently see is that families, and it's not just after deportation, it's also right while someone's in the immigration detention system, families will end up reliant on public benefits who never previously were, because they've lost their breadwinner, they've lost their father, they've lost their spouse to the immigration detention removal proceedings. And, you know, what I have come to really strongly believe is that in the ordinary case, a deportation for a green card holder for a criminal offense has more negative impacts on American citizens than it would be if that person would be permitted to reunify with their family in the community and rehabilitate.
So if you're just tuning in, you are listening to WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk. I'm Andre Hakes. My guest today is Heidi Altman, who is with the CARE Coalition, which is an immigrant rights group. So Heidi, talk to me about what kinds of things. There are different classifications of offenses for immigration purposes than for criminal justice purposes. I know this just because I'm a criminal defense attorney, and over time it's kind of blown my mind as I've had to learn more about how immigration might affect my clients.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what a crime of moral turpitude is in immigration world. And let me lead off that question by saying a crime of moral turpitude in criminal defense world means lying, cheating, stealing.
Mm-hmm.
It's something, and the term is used to talk about impeachment. If somebody testifies and they've previously been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude, lying, cheating, stealing, you can say, "Isn't it true, Mr. Witness, that you were convicted of a crime of moral... How many crimes of moral turpitude have you been convicted of, right?" And it's used to sort of discredit that person. What's a crime of moral turpitude for immigration?
I'm laughing because I struggle to explain this to defense attorneys all the time. It is a term of art in immigration law that really means very little. But the impact is that if you're a non-citizen and you've been convicted of something that an immigration judge decides is a crime involving moral turpitude, that can frequently mean deportation, and in some cases, mandatory deportation if you don't have a defense available to you. So I think lying, cheating, stealing, you're right, that's sort of the basic idea. But the problem is that there's no piece of paper that defines what a crime involving moral turpitude is. And the courts have struggled to interpret it for years. So one of our programs at CARE Coalition is that we endeavor to provide support and training and consultations to criminal defense attorneys who, as you're saying, Andre, are doing their best to meet what is their constitutional obligation to advise their clients about the deportation risks that they're going to face from a criminal charge. And we really struggle, and they really struggle, because often there is no way to know for sure if an offense is going to be considered a crime involving moral turpitude by ICE or by an immigration judge.
What do you mean there's no way to know for sure? I mean, doesn't the law say, you know, that it has to be clear? There's this idea of ex post facto laws.
Right.
You can't make something a law later. You have to give somebody reasonable notice of what the law is before
right.
you can punish them for breaking it.
Right. Well, so when you talk about disparate impact, you know, there are different protections available in criminal proceedings than there are in immigration proceedings. And a lot of the protections that American citizens and non-citizens get in the criminal justice system just don't exist in immigration court because deportation is not considered to be a crime. So, I'll start with some of these notice requirements. A crime involving moral turpitude, there are a lot of offenses, even here in Virginia, that some immigration judges in our area will consider to be a crime involving moral turpitude, and others will consider not to be a crime involving moral turpitude.
Really? That sounds like what might happen to you if you got a speeding ticket in one jurisdiction or another in
right.
Virginia.
Yeah. So it happens in other contexts, but in this context, the stakes are really high. The stakes are deportation and separation from your family and your community. But the difference between the criminal justice system and immigration, I think the most common thing we hear from our clients who are facing deportation proceedings because of a criminal conviction is that it feels like double jeopardy to them, because they have been given a sentence by a criminal court judge and they have completed that sentence. And then at the end of doing everything they were asked to do by the judge, they're then taken into immigration detention and facing this really a crisis moment in their lives, and it feels like double jeopardy. And we always have to explain that it feels like double jeopardy and it looks like double jeopardy, but because deportation is not considered to be a criminal punishment, technically it's not, and they don't benefit from that protection.
Well, another sort of class of offenses, another term that I hear sometimes when I'm talking to my immigration lawyer friend with whom I consult on such
yes.
cases,
yes.
Is aggravated felony.
Yeah.
Now, in criminal defense world, a felony is a crime that carries with it, at least in state criminal defense world, the possibility of a sentence in excess of 12 months.
Right.
Okay? It is not spitting on the sidewalk.
Right.
It is not even DUI, except if it's a third offense DUI within 10 years.
Yeah.
It is something, murder, rape, robbery, those are felonies, right?
Right.
And then when you think about an aggravated felony, my God, you know, it's got to be something terrible.
Yeah.
And I'm often surprised at what aggravated felony means in immigration world.
Me too. We always, I frequently joke that an aggravated felony can be neither a felony nor aggravated.
Well, give me an example. What's an aggravated felony offense that you're like, that criminal defense lawyers are like, what?
Yeah. Well, so there are a lot of theft offenses that can be categorized as aggravated felonies. And one problem with the aggravated felony definition is that for some but not offenses, it becomes an aggravated felony if you get a sentence of a year or more. But in immigration court, a suspended sentence counts. So what that means in day-to-day terms is that, you know, the judge gives you 12 months, but he suspends all 12. And so you never serve a day in jail. But when you get to immigration court, that's considered to be a full year jail.
So wait. Let's say you shoplifted a DVD from Walmart,
yeah.
right? And
yeah.
it's a misdemeanor petty larceny offense.
Yeah.
And at sentencing, you got 12 months all suspended.
Yeah.
Or 12 months with all but one day suspended, or something of that nature. Would that be an aggravated felony?
Yeah, well, it's a funny question, and kind of very, the answer is reflective of how much and frequently the law changes.
Mm-hmm.
So petty larceny in Virginia happens to be a statute, an actual offense that went all the way up to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals recently.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fourth Circuit Appeals looked at various different pieces of case law and said, you know, this actually is not an aggravated felony for immigration purposes. Now, there are other theft offenses, though, that could still be considered.
Like what?
So there are some, for example, a lot of any offense that has a fraud element can very easily become an aggravated felony. One aggravated felony category that we have a lot of clients struggling with now is what's called the drug trafficking aggravated felony ground. So that sounds
okay. It sounds pretty bad. Sounds like you're a gangbanger from, you know, somewhere who's brought up. You know.
Yeah, you're like a narco kingpin.
Coke.
But in actuality, all it requires is one conviction for possession with intent to distribute. And that can include, in some cases, marijuana. And so it may be a serious offense, and, you know, I don't mean to downplay that, but I do see playing out in our country a conversation about sentencing reform for drug offenses. And that conversation I don't see happening on the immigration side. And
well, let's talk about distribute for a second.
Yeah.
In criminal world, you hear, as a layperson, you hear distribution, and you think, you know, drug kingpin, right? But I've had cases before where somebody gets charged with distribution because they had a joint and they handed it to somebody else to take a puff on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they just distributed. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, we can be talking about anything that resulted in a plea. And you're in criminal court a lot, Andre, so you know all the reasons why people end up taking a plea. You know, more than 95% of cases in the criminal justice system today are resolved by plea. And sometimes that's because people are taking responsibility for an offense that they committed. But sometimes it's because they cannot spend another day in jail and need to be home with their family for Christmas or for their son's birthday, or because they are so scared of the immigration consequences of what would happen if they go to trial that they take another plea and they were misadvised on the immigration consequences of that plea.
Most of the time in my world, it's because the potential sentence is so enormous and the prosecutor decides what to charge you with. So you might have somebody who got in a fist fight, and the prosecutor decides to charge malicious wounding. And the potential consequence is 20 years in prison. And so some clients are just risk-averse enough that they will say, I am not going to trial on that. You know, I will plead guilty to misdemeanor assault and battery so that I won't have to run that risk, even though I did not start this fight. I am not guilty of assault and battery. But I'll take that plea for something I'm not guilty of because I don't want to take that chance of this enormous consequence.
Right. And so what happens if you're a non-citizen is that then all of the problems and the injustices that occur every day in our criminal justice system play out again when you face the immigration judge in immigration court and you are held to account again for whatever injustices occurred there.
Well, and some people are not aware that that's coming.
That's the real
problem there, is that they don't know. So there were some recent cases that were decided that were intended to sort of at least put criminal defendants on notice, that they might be dealing with this. Can you talk to me about Padilla versus Kentucky. What's that case about?
Sure. So Padilla versus Kentucky was at the Supreme Court of the United States in 2010, and this was a real wake-up moment, I think, for immigration attorneys and criminal defense attorneys across the country. But so Mr. Padilla...
It scared the bejesus out of me when I read it.
Well, I think it caused panic for a lot of people, and there's, you know, a lot of us who are trying to help with that because it's a big responsibility for criminal defense attorneys, but it's an important one. Mr. Padilla was a longtime green card holder and, in fact, a veteran of the Vietnam War who had lived in the United States for many, many years. And he ended up with a conviction for, you know, again, this category of crimes in the United States is considered to be drug
trafficking. Wait. Mr. Padilla was a veteran of the Vietnam War.
He was.
On the side of the U.S.?
He was.
So he served in the U.S. military.
That's right. As a green card holder, because that's permitted.
He was a legal permanent resident.
Legal permanent resident.
And he served in the U.S. military in wartime.
He did.
Okay, so tell me what happens to Mr. Padilla.
So he got put in removal proceedings because of this conviction for drug distribution.
What was the drug distribution?
I don't know the facts of it, and I don't know Mr. Padilla personally, but, you know, I do know some of the folks who worked on his case. I don't think that they alleged that he was innocent. I think that what happened is that he told his criminal defense attorney that he was green card holder. Now, in that case, he was given bad advice.
Okay. What happened? What did his lawyer say?
His lawyer said, you know, basically you don't have to worry about it because you got a green card. And I think that that is a common and understandable, in fact, misperception. It is called lawful permanent residence.
Mm-hmm.
And so
clients
say to us all the time, well, what does the permanence mean there if I can end up with a criminal conviction and then be put... You know, the problem for Mr. Padilla is that what ended up happening when he was put in removal proceedings is that he faced mandatory deportation.
Wait, how did he get put in removal proceedings to begin with? I mean, what did the lawyer recommend that he do, and what did he ultimately do?
Well, he took a plea on his lawyer's advice.
Okay.
As we've been discussing, happens so frequently. And he, you know, and the ways that people come into immigration detention from the criminal justice system happens in many different ways. Some people get handed over to immigration authorities right from jail. Other people get picked up on probation. We have many, many clients who are, in fact, picked up in their homes.
Now, the plea that he took, it probably wasn't bad advice in the criminal system.
I think that's right. I think that if he had been a citizen, it probably would have been very good advice and a good plea for him. And that's frequently the irony of this, is that as a criminal defense attorney, I understand it's very hard to reorient yourself to think about an entirely different set of case outcome goals.
Well, and the criminal defense attorney in that case, it sounds like, did think about it. He just was wrong on what the law was. He wasn't an immigration lawyer.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, the thing about the sort of category of offenses that we call, you know, mandatory deportation offenses, is what I mean by mandatory deportation is that, you know, Mr. Padilla would have literally had no opportunity to ask an immigration judge to consider the positive facts of his life. So even if the immigration judge was swayed by, for example, his service, which is compelling to many of us, the judge would have not been able to consider that.
Well, Padilla was decided in 2010. So if he served in Vietnam, he must have been here for a long time.
For a long, long time. He was here for a long, long time. But an aggravated felony, this is why, you know, we worry about aggravated felonies so much. An aggravated felony makes you completely ineligible for almost any type of defense to your deportation. So you get in front of an immigration judge, and there's just nothing you can do, and there's nothing the judge can do. Their hands are tied as well. And, you know, that's a lot of what the Supreme Court considered in Padilla versus Kentucky, because it wasn't always that way.
So we're going to take a break for just a moment, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
This is Straight Talk with Andre Hakes. My guest today is Heidi Altman of the CARE Coalition, and we are talking about immigrant rights issues. So, in Padilla, the holding of Padilla, as I understand it, was essentially the U.S. Supreme Court said, you lousy criminal defense lawyers, you need to be telling these people what their immigration rights are. And if you don't tell them what their immigration rights are, you have committed ineffective assistance of counsel. That's sort of the upshot of Padilla. And I remember reading that in 2010 and being like, what? I know nothing about immigration.
Yeah.
So I guess there's been an effort to educate defense counsel, and defense attorneys have been trying to educate themselves about this. Immigration is pretty complicated. There are so many little nuances of that law and ways to get it wrong that that's kind of scary to counsel.
Yes, and I respect that as a criminal defense attorney. If I were a criminal defense attorney, I imagine I too would be intimidated by it. And I think the key is that the immigration and the criminal defense bar really have to work together on this. I believe that really strongly. And, you know, so we started this program at CARE Coalition about a year and a half ago now, where we're traveling throughout Virginia and training public defenders and providing case consultations to defense attorneys who are representing indigent non-citizens. And it is a lot of ground to cover. and there are a lot of misperceptions and a lot of people trying really hard to meet their obligations, but with very few resources in place to allow them to do so. So I think, you know, there's a lot of work to be done there still, and not just here in Virginia, but across the country. There are some innovative models in place where immigration attorneys and criminal defense attorneys are working together. You have places like New York, where most public defender offices have 1, 2, sometimes 5 or more in-house immigration attorneys. But that's not the norm. The norm is still places like Virginia, where the entire indigent defense system is supported by 1 or maybe 2 immigration attorneys who are running around the state trying to provide the support needed by this entire bar of attorneys trying to meet their constitutional obligations.
Well, I am a privately retained attorney most of the time for my criminal defense cases. I refuse to take cases from the court-appointed system. I will occasionally do a pro bono case, but I just won't participate in that system.
Right.
But my answer to this has been that I consult with an immigration attorney when I have a client and I find out that I've got an immigrant client who's a non-citizen. If they immigrated and they got their U.S. citizenship, I don't have to worry about it. But if they didn't, then I call this person and I write them a letter and I send them the documents and I pay them some money, which ultimately goes back, you know, the client is who pays.
Right.
And I say, explain this to me. And I've been doing this now since about 2010, when I became aware of Padilla.
Right.
I probably did it a few times before when I had something that was serious enough that I went, I really need to follow up on this.
Right.
But I've been doing it, you know, regularly.
Right.
And I still don't understand.
Right.
I watched you speak. That's how I met you. I watched you speak at the Virginia Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers presentation in Charlottesville this past fall. And I loved your presentation. It was awesome. I learned so much about what I don't know. But I still don't know it. So it's a little bit of a problem. But in any event, there was some confusion after Padilla as to what exactly we were supposed to do. There was a case in this year, earlier this year, that sort of clarified that for the defense bar. Would you talk a little bit about that case?
Right. I think it clarified it in a way that probably would only increase the anxiety of some on the defense
bar.
But it's good to know.
And it's probably the right call.
So I do think it's the right call. And I think the facts of this particular case really show why it's the right call. Mr. Zameen was also, like Mr. Padilla, a green card holder.
This is Zameen versus Clark.
That's
Virginia
right.
Virginia Supreme Court, 2015.
Just February, this past February. I know. Look at you, Andre. It was an important case in Virginia, and Mr. Zameen was put in removal proceedings for a theft offense, like we were talking about a few minutes ago.
I never heard about this case before your presentation, by the way.
Okay.
That's why I'm kind of laughing over here.
We're trying to get the word out.
The one who taught me about this case.
Okay, I feel good about that. But in this case, I think the big takeaway from this case is that he was not deported because of his conviction. He spent a long time in detention and really struggled for it.
But first off, give us the facts of the case.
Yeah, so this was a theft offense, but it was a shoplifting offense. It was $33 worth of beer.
Beer. You know what kind of beer it was? Was it really good beer? Was
I wish
like
I knew. I got
bad beer.
No. I'm going to call his attorney and find that out.
All right, we'll ask.
It was probably bad beer, don't you think?
$33 worth?
I would hope
it would have been good beer. I mean, how do you get out that much, bad beer anyway?
It's true. But he was struggling in his life for various ways that I think are understandable when contextualized. And he was put into, he spent a lot of time in detention. And when he was put in removal proceedings, he was stripped of his green card status. And he was only allowed to stay in the United States in a temporary form of status that allows him to work lawfully.
All right, now wait a second. Just back up with me for a second.
Yeah.
So this guy is charged with shoplifting $33 worth of beer.
Yeah.
And he has an attorney.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because that's a jailable offense.
That's right.
Right? So he's got a right to counsel.
In criminal court.
So does he take a plea? Or is he convicted? What happens?
Yes. So he was not given any advice about the immigration consequences of the offense, right? Which is a little bit different from
Mr. 5 years after Padilla versus
Right.
Kentucky.
He's not given any advice. What I understand is that he was given a very short amount of time to talk with his attorney, that the deal that was on the table looked good from the perspective of any other case. If it had been a citizen, for example, it probably was. It was a deal that got him out of jail in time to be home for his birthday. And that was important to him, and he didn't know that what should have been more important to him was whether or not he was going to spend a year in immigration detention. And he just, and when I say he didn't know, I mean he truly, it did not, I don't think it dawned on him that that could possibly be a consequence of this plea.
Do you know if this was a first offense?
I don't know.
Or not.
I don't know the answer.
I'm just thinking
to that.
About like typical sentences that I see for shoplifting something small. You know, you might get 30 days all suspended the first time. You might get a weekend in jail the first time. Just sort of depends on what happens, right? Certainly the second time, you might be looking at, you're definitely looking at some jail time that's going to be active, but nobody's getting a year for
Yeah, he may have had some priors. I don't know his record.
Well, but it sounds like he didn't get a year sentence out of the criminal system, which is what I'm saying. I mean, he might have, if he got to go home before his birthday, if they're thinking about that.
Well, so he got to go home before his birthday, but he was given, he had at least a year, including suspended time. And this is the trick that we talked about before, where the suspended time comes back to get you.
Right. Well, I said nobody's getting a year. I mean, nobody's getting an active year.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
I would expect he got something like, a year with X suspended, and the X might have been, 11 months and 15 days. I mean,
but that's why, that's why it is a good deal if you're a U.S. citizen. It is not a good deal if you're not a citizen, because the suspended time counts exactly the same. But so I think why this case is so important is because the Virginia Supreme Court looked at this and said his attorney didn't advise him, and he ended up in some senses okay, and that he's still in the United States and he didn't have to return to Ethiopia where his life would have been in danger. But the fact that he lost his green card was prejudice enough to him that what his attorney did was ineffective assistance of counsel.
So he isn't told that he's got an immigration problem.
Right.
Probably because his attorney doesn't know. Think of it.
Right.
And then he takes this deal. Yeah. It was a plea deal. So he agrees to something. And this something, while being a good deal in terms of his time he's going to spend in jail on his criminal charge, in the end, it has this immigration consequence. He loses his green card. And what happens to him physically? Like, literally, what happens to him?
He was taken into an immigration detention facility. Because he wasn't our client, I don't know the details, but I believe
he took
it was
a deal
shortly after
to stay out of jail.
Right.
And he got put in jail.
Yeah. So the That's right.
Got held in jail for how long?
He was there for, I believe, about a year.
Got held in jail for a full year on a deal that should have netted him next to nothing.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right, because that's not, again, considered to be a punishment under our current laws. You know, I mean, I keep coming back to that.
You put somebody in a jail for a year, and it's not a criminal penalty?
That's right, that's wrong. I think, the people who know best how sort of wrong the way we think about this is are the people who are in the immigration detention facilities and who are experiencing what clearly is punishment, but is not by law defined as punishment. But for him it was, that time in immigration detention, I know for him, has left a lot of scars, and it does for everyone who experiences it.
So what's the holding of Zameen? What does the court say in Zameen?
So the court says in Zameen, the court thinks a lot about what Padilla means and reaffirms that criminal defense attorneys have this obligation. And the court says this obligation isn't just about the risk of deportation. It's about the risk of negative immigration consequences.
Okay.
And so if your client is about to take a plea and that's going to cause extensive time in immigration detention, or it's maybe going to cause her to lose her green card, even if eventually she she's allowed to stay here. You need to talk with your client about all of these possible risks of negative immigration consequences, not just deportation.
It's not just your client you need to talk to, though. When I read Zameen, Zameen also has sort of some language in there that says you need to talk about this with the prosecutor in trying to negotiate your plea.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is kind of fascinating, because I've certainly had some prosecutors who I've dealt with who, you know, if they know my person's an immigrant, it's not going to be a plus. It's not
right.
going to mean, you know, hey, you know, this is what's going to happen to him. Please don't do this to him. It's
right.
going to be, you know, yeah. stick it to him harder.
Well, you know, I think that the holding with regard to the prosecution in Zameen is that you, Andre, as a criminal defense attorney, have to defend your client against negative immigration consequences. And you may make the strategic call that the best way to do that is to bring this up in plea negotiations with the prosecutor, or you may decide in a particular case, knowing your prosecutor, that that's not the right strategic call here. And I do think that the decision leaves room on that that question. That's your strategic call as the lawyer, right?
It just basically means you have to think about it and you have to make a strategic decision as opposed to a non-decision.
That's right.
In which you don't even consider it.
That's right. But I hope that prosecutors are reading Zameen, too. And I hope that prosecutors are reading Padilla, because one of the most interesting parts of the language in Padilla is that the Supreme Court talks about plea negotiations. Like, how frequently has the Supreme Court talked about plea negotiations? Not a lot. And they talk about the fact that it is appropriate for prosecutors and defense attorneys to be sitting down and talking about immigration consequences as part of the plea process. Because, I've spoken with a lot of prosecutors who felt like this wasn't their role, it wasn't appropriate for them to be getting involved in what's a federal enforcement system. And mm-hmm. the Supreme Court now has said, you know, no, it is an appropriate part of this process.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't thought about the idea that you might want to tell the prosecutor to read Zameen from the perspective of, oh, yes, it is appropriate to talk about this. That is interesting. All right, so I thought Zameen didn't get any active jail time. I thought that he just got released.
No, he did get released at the plea.
So it could have been a plea for no jail time, or it could have been a plea for time served.
Right.
I understand he didn't actually get deported. And
that's
the
right.
reason he didn't actually get deported is because of this case.
Before this case was decided, he was granted something called withholding of removal.
Okay.
Withholding of removal is akin to asylum, mm-hmm. but not as good. So basically, withholding of removal is available for people who would face certain persecution if they went back to their countries. He was from Ethiopia and would have faced horrors if he went back there for various reasons. You know, withholding of removal, though, is a type of limited protection that comes with a deportation order, right? So
right.
it's called withholding because it means you get ordered deported.
We order you
but
deported, but we're going to withhold the deportation that we just ordered.
We're not going to do it right now. It's not a very stable status. You cannot bring family members here to join you with withholding, and you never can get a green card through withholding or citizenship.
I understand his conviction was vacated.
That's right.
But my question then is, was it vacated to be retried? Now that you are educated on these, you know, immigration
right.
consequences, now
right.
that, you know, now you're going to have a lawyer who's going to tell you all this stuff.
Right.
Did they retry him? Do you know?
So my understanding is that his case is still ongoing and has not been resolved.
Wow. Okay.
But he has a team working with him.
Wow. So I want to ask you about another person. I know that the CARE Coalition represents a fellow named Rodolfo Padilla. Mm. This is not the Padilla of Padilla versus
Kentucky.
This is a
different Mr. Padilla. That's right. You can call him Rudy. That's what he goes by.
So tell me about Rudy. Tell me about sort of, you know, how Rudy came to be in the U.S. and sort of his background, and then what's happened to him.
Yeah.
I think he's representative of a whole class of cases.
He is representative of a whole class of cases. And yeah, Rudy's got a long and really interesting story. He is a longtime green card holder of the United States. He's been here for, I believe, over 30 years. His whole family is here. His son is here. His wife, from whom he's separated, but who he has a good relationship with. Siblings, parents, you know, his whole family is here. He thinks of himself as American.
How old was Rudy when he came to the U.S.?
I believe he was 11, although I'd need to double check that.
But he was a child.
He was a child.
wasn't a grown-up.
No, he was a child. And he's, you know, he's one of many people who, clients, that when we speak with them, they say that they identify as American.
Okay.
And people don't naturalize for, you know, for various reasons. But for Rudy, he's had some struggles in his life, like many of us, you know. And he became involved with drugs, and he ended up in 2009 with a serious drug conviction.
He ended up in federal prison,
right? That's right.
And is this is one of those crack powder cocaine cases,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
There was a sentencing structure at some point in the federal system where if you got caught with X amount of crack, you got a ridiculously huge sentence, where if you got caught with X amount of powder, you got still not a good sentence, but not a ridiculously huge sentence. And that was changed. At some point, the federal guidelines were sort of restructured, and there were a lot of people who had their federal sentences reduced as
That's
a result,
right.
because it was felt to be discriminatory.
That's right.
There was sort of a race element in terms of who was using crack versus who was using powder.
Very significant race element.
And it got changed.
Yeah.
So Padilla is one of those guys who benefited from that, sort of, in that he got released from federal custody early, right? So he gets out of prison. And what
happens? He never really got out of prison is what happened to Rudy. So, you know, this sentencing reduction that you're talking about, Rudy was one of many, about 6,000, actually, people who benefited from, you know, what has been sort of a very slow but march toward progress on the idea of reducing disparities in drug sentencing in the United States and reducing the mass incarceration of people of color because of drug convictions. So he benefited from this sentencing reform. And when I say he benefited from it, it's important to remember that a federal judge considered his case, looked at his case, and decided that he had done well for himself in prison, that he would not be any risk to the community if he was released, and that he should have the opportunity to go back to his family.
Let me put you on hold for just a second. If you have a call, if you have a question you want to ask Heidi, we've got a few minutes left. We're going to keep talking about Padilla, but if you want to call in right now, the studio line is 284-9470. My producer will pick you up, and we'll get you on the air. So go ahead, Heidi.
Yeah.
So keep talking about Padilla.
So Rudy benefits from this sentencing reduction, he and about 6,000 others, except that he's a non-citizen. And mm-hmm. so at some point it became clear to him that, in fact, he and about 2,000 of this group of 6,000 were, instead of being released, going to be going straight into immigration custody. We in the advocacy community have been trying to figure out exactly what is happening to this group of people, and it's been very hard to get information. We don't know where they all are. We don't know exactly how many of them have already been deported, but
why?
We understand that's
why
a lot.
Can't you get that information? That should be easy. I mean, we know there were 6,000 people. I'm sure the federal prison system has the information on who they were, and mm-hmm. so why can't you find them?
Because the federal prison system, when they hand them over to ICE, mm-hmm. doesn't then ICE becomes the owner of the knowledge about where they are, because then they're in this national network of ICE jails that we talked about previously.
So you can find out who they are from the federal prisons, but not where they are?
That's right. That's right.
And ICE won't tell you?
Well, we could sit down with ICE's online detainee locator and put in all 2,000 names. but there's not a lot of immigrant advocates doing this work with limited resources. What we have at CARE Coalition been able to do is at least identify those among this group who are in detention in Virginia. And we have been working with them and trying to educate them about their rights. And, of course, that's how we met Rudy. And we were really moved by Rudy's story. And Rudy and several other young men, and you know, I say young men, but the truth is that many of these men have come from significant time in custody. Some of them are in their 50s, some of them are in their 60s. They have U.S. citizen kids, and some of them have U.S. citizen grandkids. And, you know, to me, one of the ironies of this situation that Rudy and others face is that the taxpayers really been paying for a lot of the work that they've been doing in their time in prison mm-hmm. to get their GEDs, to develop skills so that they can get back out into the community and support their families. But instead, we're just sending them back to their countries of origin, where their families here in the United States waiting for them.
What happens to the, before we go on, if you need that number again, it's 2-800-770. The studio line number is 284-9470. What happens to their families? What happens to the folks who are left behind?
They struggle. And, you know, for Rudy, we've been talking with his son, we've been talking with his family, and they're heartbroken, obviously, right? And they finally see this opportunity for their family to be reunited. They see the changes that Rudy has made during his time in custody, and they want to have the opportunity to support him in making good on the recommitment he has made to his life. And they are going to lose the opportunity to do that if he's deported. In many cases, we have another client named Junior who's in a very similar situation to Rudy, but he has young kids in the United States. Mm-hmm. He's from the Dominican Republic. His wife has talked to us about this wrenching choice that she's now trying to make about whether she would bring her kids to the Dominican Republic. She's a U.S. citizen. Their kids are U.S. citizens. And she knows that they will have many fewer opportunities there. For their education, for their livelihoods, but she has to choose between trading that off for having them grow up in a whole family with their father. It's a struggle. And, you know, again, I think I mentioned this before, but the financial reality of it is that when someone like Junior or like Rudy is deported, then the families that are left behind struggle financially, and studies show that repeatedly.
Well, so the states are not providing immigration assistance for folks, for immigrants who are charged with crimes.
Right.
They've got a criminal defense attorney, and the states or the court system are now sort of saying, criminal defense attorneys, you guys do it.
Yeah.
Right? But the vast majority of people in the criminal system who are represented by criminal defense attorneys, they're public defenders or people who are appointed. And so they're getting paid a sort of would-you-like-fries-with-that rate. And now they're supposed to learn this whole other body of law. But there's another complication of this that I've tumbled onto recently, which is that the state's always trying to save money. And if you've got somebody who has, for example, shoplifted $33 worth of beer, just to take that as a fact pattern example, and the prosecutor knows it's a first offense, and they know that their judge isn't going to give this person active jail time on the first offense, the prosecutor can just say, we're waiving jail on this case. And when they say we're waiving jail on this case, what that means is that person doesn't get appointed a criminal defense attorney, which then means that person's criminal defense attorney, who's, you know, would you like fries with that, isn't going to tell that person that if you take a plea, you're going to spend a year in immigration detention and then be separated from your family for the rest of your life. Is this a problem? Do you see this as a problem?
That is an underestimate, right? This, to me, is just a black hole of justice in Virginia and in other states where there are misdemeanor courts, where there's no right to counsel if jail is off the table. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the legal ethics section of the bar recently considered this in Virginia and thought about what the ethical responsibility of the prosecutor is. And we encouraged them, we at CARE Coalition and a few other organizations encouraged them to adopt the position that the prosecutor cannot ethically proceed in a case involving a non-citizen unless counsel is appointed. And of course that was not adopted.
Boy, I bet that wasn't real popular.
That didn't go very far. But no, I think there are a lot of states in our union where you get an attorney when you're facing a criminal offense, regardless of whether jail is on the table, and all of those states have figured out a way to pay for it. And it just, I can't describe to me how baffling it is to think that now you're getting hit doubly. We already struggle with the fact that we know our clients are going to face the deportation system without a lawyer, but to imagine that they would go all the way through the criminal justice system and the immigration system, end up deported and separated from their families, and never have spoken to a lawyer to advise them of that risk. It's heartbreaking.
It's kind of amazing. So I want to switch over just briefly with you in the last few minutes here and talk to you about the Syrian refugee crisis that's going on. Mm. You're my immigration expert.
I'm ready.
And I'm listening to, you know, there's a culture war happening in this country about, you know, whether we should let these people in or not let them in. Or and, of course, there's, you know, the Trumpkin tooting his horn. Can you talk to me a little bit about sort of what you see as the issues there and, and how your organization might view that?
Yeah, I can. It makes me very sad. I see this as a very important moment, obviously, for our country. But to me, the question of how we welcome refugees is foundational. And it goes to foreign policy questions, and it goes to basic justice issues. It also has been illuminating to me about the many, many ways in which even our own leading politicians don't understand the refugee and immigration system in the United States, and the idea that the refugee processing system might be an area where there are gaps in security is baffling to any of us who actually work in the immigration system.
Why?
You know, we sometimes joke that no one comes here as a refugee. The numbers are so small, relatively, and the process is so rigorous. It takes, you know, 18 to 24 months sitting in a refugee camp to go through the process of the numerous layers of security checks and background checks and discretionary determinations and interviews made by numerous government agencies and international agencies as well, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, before a refugee is actually permitted to come to the United States. And there are also screenings for looking for particular vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about refugees, you know, there's been a lot of conversation in the press about widows and children, and I think that's become kind of a political football. Mm-hmm. But that really is who we're talking about here. We're talking about the most vulnerable. And the idea that we would turn our back there, it just, it's heartbreaking to me, and I think that it is isolating and alienating to the community of immigrants who are in our country, giving back, serving in the army, serving in so many ways, giving back to our community and paying taxes, and to make that community feel this unwelcome, I just find to be very sad.
Well, I can't disagree with anything you've said, so I guess I'll leave it there. Thank you for coming in and talking to me today. It's been a real pleasure having you.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And this is Straight Talk. Next Saturday at 10 a.m., we will be speaking with John Childrey, who's the Deputy Commonwealth's Attorney in Chesterfield. And he is the erstwhile Deputy Attorney General in the Cuccinelli administration. We're going to talk about civil forfeiture. And maybe we'll talk a little about the cooch, too. I don't know. We'll see. I'm Audrey Hakes, and I'm signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend, y'all.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Audrey Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August. Engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.